Diana was the title of my least favourite film, but I'll put that aside. Although off air we were discussing the fact that large shipments of pianos arrived in Australia and were sunk, never to be seen again.
They arrived frequently, such was the obsession. And in fact, there's a rather wonderful painting I came across by Bernard Hesling, who was an extraordinary English actor, comedian, painter. And he talks about a piano being landed at Glenelg Beach, the governor's wife's piano, and ended up, you know, in the ocean. In fact, when there weren't wharves, pianos had to be kind of barged across, you know, the threshold. And
Where Jane Campion got her inspiration?
Yeah, of course. People slept under pianos at Western Australia.
Before we get to Australia, the piano has a very long history in music, been evolving for yonks. But probably the biggest moment in its evolution was in Florence at the start of the 18th century.
Yes, that's when Cristofori decided to start tinkering with a harpsichord, you know, the plucked instrument, and he invented a new action called the piano a forte, literally the loud and the soft. So the strings were being struck rather than pluck. We went from a strucker to a plucker, or a plucker to a strucker.
And why is that so transformative?
Volume. Being able to express dynamic volume change in the instrument. Obviously, it had been tried before, but with a harpsichord, you could only do that by doubling the number of strings or stops. Now, initially, this was only the preserve of aristocrats, and we know that the early great composers weren't very, you know, enamoured. Bach wasn't particularly taken initially.
He required modifications before granting his blessing.
Yes, he did. And in fact, as this instrument suddenly shifted from the aristocratic world to the secular world, it was going to be radically modified. And really, I think the genesis of the piano today could be defined in a term that came from a friend of mine, Sandra Ridgewell. She called it the iron ship of the 19th century. Once you had a wooden frame and you substituted a metal frame, it makes it robust, it's loud, and it will not have the light, polite tinkle anymore. It can be thumped. The Germans got onto this very quickly. They followed the Americans, who saying, we want to make a stronger piano. The French said, oh, we want to keep it wooden, and the British twiddled their thumbs. So that's why the British piano industry and the French piano industry fell by the wayside in Australia, at least.
Since the 1770s, the piano has been the centre of professional and amateur music making.
Yeah, it's the karaoke machine pre-electricity. It's a lot more, of course. It is the symbol of middle class aspiration. So you can imagine a miner in Lithgow making a few bob and thinking, I better buy a piano for my daughter. And he's prepared to go into hock because ladies played the piano. It was polite. So there's a whole gender issue there.
We were talking before we started this official chat, and I was telling you that I've got a very ancient piano made in England in the late 18th century, which is a hitter, not a plucker, short keyboard, wooden frame, and over the years that it's twisted a little. The frame is twisted. Yeah. So you can see the positive advantage of being a tub-thumping iron.
Well, that's right. And in fact, that was the important rubric for the Australian piano makers, Beale and Wertheim, that they were producing instruments for Australian conditions using local timber. If you start importing pianos from Europe and putting them in sailing ships, once they got here into the extremes of an Australian climate, they would warp and split and break. The iron frame made them probably more resilient. But Beale and Wertheim said, let's make them here.
We know that a fine violin can have a shelf life, a playing life of centuries. How long can a piano last?
80 years, 80 to 100 years, probably. I think that's what my research shows, talking to
technicians. That would be about the same as a good quality harp.
Yeah, that's right. Look, I think the comparison with a violin, it needs to be tested, because the violins that we revere today, with these ridiculous prices pushed by Wall Street, have been many times modified and changed, but there's no doubt this little singing box.
So there may be little left of the original.
Most of the instruments that we play today have steel strings, but they're originally gut. So they were less robust. There's a lot of work gone in, but I suppose the piano has many thousands of parts. The violin is this little singing box with four strings, and it's not hard to tweak it.
Okay, I'm talking to a lovely fellow called Michael Atherton, and he's now going to tell us, this is a very personal question, Michael, the one piano that came on the first fleet.
The one piano that came on the first fleet was a very small instrument by today's standards, and it was brought by Surgeon George Worgan. And there's some research on this that suggested might even be surviving now in Australia. But this tiny instrument, possibly made by an English maker, Beck, had a very different sound. This instrument was very expensive. It was the preserve of aristocrats.
Square, I understand.
Yeah, although it was more of a rectangular shape. They called it a square piano.
Right.
It ended up with Elizabeth MacArthur, and Worgan taught her a few tunes on it before he went back to England. But once Worgan got here and ships were coming, the ships were literally full to the gunwales with pianos, concertinas, you name it, brass instruments. Australians just couldn't get enough. But the piano was the one thing they really coveted, hence my title.
Of course, making music at home was one of the ways of filling in time, wasn't it? There wasn't a lot of social alternatives.
No, and in fact, you could imagine the isolation of women in the remote back blocks of Australia to be able to get a piano taken there on a bullock dray, or even my poor suffering camel, to get a piano was a fabulous thing. And there are wonderful descriptions by, say, Miles Franklin about getting her piano lugged through the bush to her homestead. It was an amazing solace. But I think it goes a lot further too, because when the piano is eventually taken to war on ships and put in the trenches, soldiers and nurses and helpers who played the piano saw it as a symbol of world order, not the chaos of war. So by clustering around the piano,
I had no idea.
Oh,
they made it into active combat.
Oh yeah, I didn't make the book. I don't think we got the copyright, but I have a picture of a piano outside a bunker in 1918 in Belgium. Aussies have a piano outside this sandbag bunker which they played.
As you know, I'm quite elderly, Michael, but nonetheless, I couldn't get a ticket to the first concert of the Melbourne Philharmonic in 1853, where they performed, guess what, Handel's Messiah.
Yeah.
Why was Handel so important?
Well, you can imagine Australia read Britain in 1850 and read Protestantism, the great Saxon musician, the Messiah. I mean, Novello was starting to put things into print. This was what Australians wanted, and eventually we kind of subverted that.
He was seen as unimpeachably moral, wasn't he?
Very, very moral, and that was also a vector for piano. The piano was a civilizing instrument. Women played it.
It was demure to play. Like watching a woman play a cello.
Oh, yeah.
Example,
or
which is outrageous.
Screwing their mouth up playing an oboe.
Absolutely.
It was dreadful.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And yet, it's wonderful that the piano became a liberating instrument for women. A woman, alas, who became a widow, if she were a piano teacher and a player, she could go out and earn money. She could eventually play in silent movies. So she wasn't just housebound. You were supposed to stay home and cook and look after the paterfamilias and play the piano. Suddenly, she became an economic entity in her own right, and especially in the First World War.
LNL on RN, download us wherever you get your podcasts, or indeed play us on your piano. And I'm talking with Michael Atherton. Despite the best efforts of the Blue Bloods to keep pianos for themselves, a growing force of democratisation, how was it most clearly expressed?
The piano, once it had an iron frame and you had makers in Australia and you had musical houses such as Allen's and Brash's became readily available at a cheaper price. In fact, the Germans began making cheap pianos. Some of them were good, some of them were bad. And to give you an idea, at the exhibition in Sydney, the first international exhibition, there were 43 German companies exhibiting. Australians couldn't get enough. So it was going to go everywhere.
It was a bit like the attitude to cars these days, wasn't it?
Well, the piano
was
the
German import, it had to be better.
And yet it didn't. The irony of this is once the war came, that I've even got a newspaper clip of a lady in Wallara, Reed Turek, as well, burning her piano because it was German.
And rightly so. Okay. I've got it. This is in parenthesis, but when did the pianola turn up? That was surely another form of democratization.
It really starts to feature in the 20s and the 30s, and it was pushed very, very hard by the salesman as making the piano even more available. Of course, what it did was to encourage people to practice less, because let's face it, to play a piano really well is a hard-fought campaign. Yes, you can tinkle, but the pianola did that. It gave people a chance to press pedals and play, but also
it was also their first experience of, in a sense, of robotics.
Well, yes, it was an automaton, and that's, you know, we were talking before I came on air about Granger and the piano rolls, and the pianola enabled this fantastic opportunity to hear great performances recorded.
Well, let's explain that. So here's the great Australian eccentric, sits down, cuts the piano rolls.
Yeah.
And what you hear when you play one of these Granger rolls is actually spine chilling, because he's alive again.
Yeah, and I think that must have been a revelation to people. They couldn't get enough. But when the pianola was happening, so was the gramophone, and the movies were becoming talkies. And so the competition for the, you know, against the piano was huge. It had another interesting revival in the 1930s. You know, if you know your history, you know what was happening in Europe. The piano and music was pushed very hard in Victoria and New South Wales, because if you give people pianos and you give them lots of singing, especially in primary schools and early adulthood, you will keep them away from all those nasty European ideas about revolution and communism and anarchy.
Didn't they know the communists played pianos?
That's right.
There's communists like Tchaikovsky.
Well, Mao Tse-tung got rid of the pianos.
You Did know, he? I didn't know.
Oh,
that.
Yes, he got rid of pianos. And
during
it,
the Cultural Revolution, the piano went...
Oh, people who played the piano were arrested. Their fingers were snapped. And yet now,
stop it.
Now you have Lang Lang, and you've got the complete volte-face, because there are 45 million children playing the piano in Australia, in China today, 300,000 pianos made per year. So China is the new bourgeois piano culture of the
Imagine
future.
If they all played the piano at the same time. I wonder if that would cause seismic problems.
I think so.
On the loud pedal.
I think Kilauea, Beijing style.
Or even you could use it as a source of energy.
You could.
You could integrate the output of all those pianos and have a piano-driven economy.
Well, the dynamo, the human dynamo, that's what I should have maybe explored in the book. As people press the pedal, they should have been attached to a dynamo. We could have produced electricity for the household.
Well, the pedal radio comes to mind.
Yeah.
Anyway, look at these. We're getting silly here. Tell me about why Beale was such a success.
Beale was a success because he linked up with Wertheim. Imagine an Irishman coming from post-famine to Australia with his
family.
He's
an Irish Quaker, indeed.
But he became a Freemason, and he did a lot better. He comes to Australia. He discovers that you can sell pianos, like selling ice creams, and he thinks, I'll make them. Wertheim does it too, and they suddenly become very, very rich men. Beale's company sells over 90,000 pianos, and what he did, became a Quaker, a Mason. He joined the Bank of New South Wales. He even went to London and was given an opportunity to be a mayor. Wertheim of Melbourne joined the Melbourne Club. He was Jewish, And he was let into the Melbourne Club. Yes, he was. And then he became a Christian. And
this would have come as a great shock to Ken Meyer, who wasn't allowed to join.
That's right. So these two, Beale, you know, they became industrialists and they built beautiful factories in Annandale and Richmond.
So they're like the Holden and Ford versus the BMWs and the Mercedes.
Absolutely. And, you know, the cultural cringe, to appropriate that term, was really big. The newspapers would savage Beale and Wertheim as making things that should be made by Britain. The whole history in Federation was about the tariff wars. The piano was the focal point of tariff wars. There were people who were almost presaging that very silly politician who said we couldn't even build a canoe in Adelaide. Well, Australians built brilliant pianos, and even the Queen bought one.
What's the best piano?
Today?
Yeah.
Gee, that's a hard one. In Australia, I'd say the Stewart Grand Piano. People say, well, you've got to play a Steinway. Well, you have, or a Fazioli. But the Wayne Stewart and Son piano that's about to come out from that sleepy little snowy river town of Tumut, 108 notes, 9 octaves, Australian timbre, brilliant ideas. The world is talking about this man who's prepared to make in his career so far 60 bespoke pianos when the Chinese can smash out 300,000. What he's making is the future.
I'm glad you brought him up because he's one of my heroes.
He's a genius. He's a great scientist, and I think that's what we've got to realise. Australia always has people that connect science and the arts and craft, and we kind of ignore them, and that's part of the inspiration for the book, people like Wayne Stewart. And that's why I'm absolutely always banging on about our great Don Bradman. He was a pianist. He played on the ships going to England. He did gigs. He recorded his own music.
You're making this up.
I am not.
You are.
Victor Trumper did it too. So, you know, let's get on board and realise the length and breadth that we can go to find out what is uniquely Australian.
Does the timbre affect the tonality?
Yes, it will.
Australian timbers can be absolutely as good as those European trees?
If not better. I mean, show me a timber anywhere else in the world that can compete with Jarrah for strength, and beautiful hue and pine that Wayne will use, and other Australian makers too. But it's also the technology and the brains. I mean, you have a great harpsichord maker in Bill Bright. Probably, I don't know whether he's still making, but he was the toast of Europe, making harpsichords from Baraba. And here's Wayne Stewart, who, you know, he was connected with Newcastle Uni and the Albert Foundation, making fabulous instruments.
Do we have a significant collection in the National Museum, or have they overlooked the piano?
I think it's largely overlooked. There are a lot of private people with pianos in sheds in the Shoalhaven and other places, but I'm pleased to say that the powerhouse, and I'm fighting to keep it, has a beautiful
Stewart piano.
That's
just over the road at the moment. Over the road. It's about to disappear.
I'd like to have my book launched there. I'd like to have my book launched there before Gladys takes it away.
Don't you blame Gladys.
Oh, no, I won't.
That's the listener, that's Gladys. Oh, you're talking about the other one.
Yes, the other one.
Oh, I don't know much about her. This is exhilarating, absolutely. So the piano is still evolving.
It's still evolving, and it will continue to evolve alongside other instruments. People said it would die. You know, it did suffer in the First World War, but it came back in the Depression. Then when TV took hold, it suffered a bit, but then the Australian piano maker Charlie Davis of Mascot reported increase in sales when Liberace turned up on the TV. Australians suddenly thought, wow, let's get a piano. So even dear old Liberace encouraged a bit of a kick to the industry. It won't die out. There'll just be better pianos. Fewer people will play it. And as we live in high rise, you won't be able to have a big Wayne Stewart grand. But if you can, go for it.
Please tell me there isn't an app that can replace them.
No. There's no app. No app can replace Australian timbre or the genius that goes into our instrument makers.